Hello, everybody. This is Scott Yates, Director of Communications and Producer Relations for the Washington Grain Commission, here with episode 52 of Wheat All About It, or what I'm calling Straight from the Horse's Mouth, about a panel discussion held during the Tri-State Grain Growers Convention at the Grand Hotel in Spokane in November. The panel included Mike Miller, chairman of U.S. Wheat Associates, who also serves on the Washington Grain Commission, Dwight Little, president of the National Barley Growers Association and an Idaho farmer, and Chandler Gould, CEO of the National Association of Wheat Growers from Washington, D.C. The three addressed a number of challenges facing the industry, including international trade, the new tax law, and yes, beer. But the three men agreed that it was ongoing negotiations over the North American Free Trade Agreement, called NAFTA, as well as presidential threats to withdraw from the pact that is the number one issue facing the nation's wheat farmers. Some context. Negotiations for the North American Free Trade Agreement, more closely linking the economies of the U.S., Canada, and Mexico, began during the first George Bush administration and was signed into law in 1993 by President Bill Clinton. In the Senate, the treaty passed by just one vote to spare, with 34 Republicans and 27 Democrats voting to approve the deal. In episode 51, you heard Jerry Hagstrom, a longtime Washington, D.C. reporter and a friend to the agricultural industry, address the NAFTA conundrum and what its loss, even chatter about its loss, means. Although I agree with Hagstrom's call to arms, especially in a region as trade-dependent as ours, an outsider's words are rarely as powerful as one's neighbor's. Dwight Little hails from Teton, Idaho, and Mike Miller from Ritzville in eastern Washington. They are your neighbors, and coming up, you'll hear from the horse's mouth how important NAFTA is for both of their commodities. But I'm starting out with Gould, the NOG CEO, who explained what the treaty has meant to the wheat market and how even discussing its demise is shaking the Mexican market.
23 years ago, before NAFTA was signed, we basically shipped zero bushels of wheat to Mexico, and they're now our largest export market. But just in the past couple of weeks, they have signed a tender for 30,000 metric tons of Argentinian wheat to come in and have also started trade missions to South America to find other suppliers due to the uncertainty that continues to surround NAFTA in the current administration.
Mike Miller followed up on Gould's comments from a U.S. Wheat Associates perspective.
And when you start to talk publicly of a renegotiation or a termination, what it does, it tips the scales out of our favor in the long-term investment from businesses into the U.S. wheat. So it's become a very delicate thing, whether it's renegotiated, whether it's terminated, those things will iron itself out. But as Chandler referred to, one of the telling signs, and about a month ago we had lunch with, Mexico only has two ag advisors for the negotiation team, and we had lunch with one of them. And he was the one that informed us about the purchase from Argentina into Mexico for the first 30,000 metric tons, with possibly two other shipments is what we're told to go in there. That's not a good sign for us because it shows weakness in our armor.
Although barley acres have diminished substantially in eastern Washington, the crop is still very important in Idaho, which regularly plants more than 500,000 acres, about 80% of which is in malt barley types for the beer industry. As you'll hear, much of the malt barley goes to Mexico and Canada. Little said fallout from a NAFTA implosion would substantially damage barley farmers.
As alluded to before, NAFTA is important. It's important to barley because most of the barley that's exported out of the United States, and especially Idaho, goes to Mexico. If we lose that market through increased competition and tariffs, it'll be difficult to make up the gap. So we're trying to encourage politicians, our legislators, everybody to see the value of NAFTA that it's been for especially the malt and the barley industry. I'll just take my own state of Idaho as an example. almost 90% of the malt barley that's exported, almost, well, maybe I could even say 95%. Of that, 75% goes to Mexico and another 15% goes to Canada. So if you take those two countries out of the mix as either through higher tariffs or lack of negotiation or whatever the problem develops in the gap in NAFTA, where are we going to sell that excess malt barley? You know, there's not much feed barley raised anymore because the price is so low that it's economically not feasible to raise it. So if you take away that big a market for your excess malt, what are you going to do with that? It's like a mountain. I'll pick on corn because they aren't here. A mountain of corn you can't get rid of. So it's a real issue for us. If we don't maintain those markets we already have, what are we going to do with the excess? One of the major malt plants in our area sends 100% of the malt out of that facility to Mexico. So, yes, there'd probably be the ability to absorb some of that excess, but you can see the economic consequences of overproduction. And it takes a long time to adjust your production back to an economically stable level if you have product you can't get rid of. So I think all of us in here understand that concept, and so that's why we need to continue the pressure on the current administration that really, in a lot of instances, NAFTA has been a good, solid agreement for us as producers in this room.
Let me repeat Little's line again. NAFTA has been a good, solid agreement for us as producers. That's it, folks. That's the bottom line. The agreement is even more important to the U.S. wheat industry today because of the world's changing trade patterns. There was a time during my history involved with the wheat industry when soft white wheat was a major player in the Middle East and Egypt, frequently taking more than 1 million tons of Northwest wheat annually. The breakup of the former Soviet Union, however, allowed for outside capital to flow into the agricultural sector of these so-called Black Sea states of Russia, Ukraine, and Kazakhstan, tremendously improving farming efficiency and yields. Recently, there's been little to no exports of soft white to Egypt, and the record is hardly better for other U.S. classes of wheat. Bowing to the changing realities of the market, U.S. Wheat Associates closed its office in Cairo earlier this year. Miller handicapped current U.S. exports to the world this way.
The world market right now has changed, as we've all read and we've heard over the past few years. The flow of wheat in U.S. wheat that we follow is 43% of our U.S. wheat exports go to Latin and South America. The other 43% goes to Asia, and only 14% of our wheat goes into the East European market, the Middle East, and Africa. That's quite a switch. It's almost a complete flop from what it was just a few decades ago.
Although trade is on everyone's minds, there are other issues closer to home that the wheat industry needs to address. When the panel gathered in November, the Republican tax bill was still under construction, and there was little hard information to go by. As I record this podcast, both the House and Senate have approved the bill, and it will now go to a conference committee to hammer out the differences between the two. It's expected the president will sign the bill before January 1st. Gould said Nog has been attempting to analyze the impact of various tax provisions that were floated, but it may come down to the type of structure a farm operates under that determines whether its taxes will go up, down, or stay the same. Recently, Gould said, a tax specialist asked him a series of questions about his farmer members.
How many of your growers are LLCs? How many of them are C-Corps? And how many of them are S-Corps? Or how many of them don't have a structure, a particular type of business structure? And to be honest, I couldn't answer the question because I don't think we as NOG have ever asked that to our membership. And so That is going to affect, you know, which directions and what part of the tax reform bill should we be looking at closely. So all of you should be expecting, and I think Josh is either still in the room. If he's not, I'll remind him. We are going to be sending something out. We clearly don't want you sending us your personal financial information, but I honestly don't know the answer to the question. Are most of you S-Corps? Are you LLCs? Or what are you? Well, how is your business structure set up? We are concerned about some of the 1031 land exchange. We're concerned about capital gains tax. We're concerned about the depreciation schedule that could be taken away from farmers. I think you'd get a one-year, one-time depreciation or tax credit as you purchase equipment. And then there's some other benefits. I know that Congressman Walz from Minnesota, Congressman Fortenberry from Nebraska, has introduced yet again a bill for beginning farmers. And, you know, this was a key emphasis that we worked on in the 2008 and the 2014 Farm Bill. I think there's some other ways that we can address getting young people into agriculture and farming and ranching. And I realize we're here with talking wheat, but it goes across the whole board here. You know, one of the ideas that we've had is by maybe reducing the capital gains tax on a farmer who is looking to retire or to get out of the industry if they're not going to pass it down to their children. If they want to sell the farm and sell it to an individual who still meets the USDA criteria of a beginning farmer, they shouldn't be hit with such a high capital gains tax. I mean, getting into agriculture is so expensive now that basically if the land is not already in your family, you're probably not going into production. So there are several areas along those lines that we think there could be some improvements to incentivize increasing agriculture participation and also increasing production and also helping that next generation get into the industry itself overall. But right now we really are concerned in order to pay for some of the tax cuts and credits that are coming through. We're looking at a possible reduction in spending in the farm bill. And though this is about taxes that we're discussing, you've also got to look at the president's budget of where he is putting the money. There's been a huge increase in defense spending. That money has to come from somewhere, and the revenue has to be generated from this tax reform bill.
There will be a lot more analysis of the bill as it undergoes revisions in the conference committee. But when he spoke at the convention, the National Barley Growers Little reminded his audience to be mindful of what their asks are, as in asking for certain provisions. He suggested the elimination of the estate tax, which now applies to individuals' estates valued over $5.49 million, may have unintended consequences.
I might just touch one thing on taxes. We might get what we ask for. We need to consider the consequences of our asks and the ramifications that might be down the road. I myself have always been an advocate of eliminating the estate tax, but maybe in that happening, we will have consequences that we don't anticipate. Maybe the step-up in basis will be eliminated. There's a whole gamut of things out there that we need to consider when we ask for things. And then if we think it's good, then continue the ask. If not, we need to readjust what we're thinking about.
The panel fielded a number of questions from the audience of Pacific Northwest farmers and other agribusiness representatives gathered for the convention. Here, Ben Adams, who completed his term as WAG president at the convention, asks a question of Chandler Gould, his NOG CEO.
If the administration decides to pull out NAFTA, can they technically by themselves do that, or does it take an act of Congress to modify those agreements?
The very unfortunate thing about trade agreements is they take years to negotiate. It's a give and take on both sides and then has to be ratified by both the House and the Senate. But we can be taken out of a trade agreement with the stroke of the pen of the president.
Bill Florey, an Idaho wheat farmer and a member of the Idaho Wheat Commission, threw out the first quality question, and Miller batted it back, observing that while the Pacific Northwest has its challenges, Midwest wheat production is under siege.
As corn and beans come west and north across the U.S., wheat acres are under pressure. Address the markets as far as wheat in the future. Is it quantity or quality or both?
I think it's both, Bill. You have the feed wheat market. You also have the end-use market. I've spent a lot of time in the Midwest. Vince Peterson, our president, he spends a lot there, too. They're going through a really, really hard time in regards to wheat production. And they actually call it wheat profitability. It's not so much the grain itself now. They're competing with themselves on profitability between corn and the bean acres. As technology advances, corn gets shorter in the days. It's made its way north. It's made its way into Canada. Probably the larger concern from the world view is, will the U.S. have enough of what our customers need to buy? So, yeah, there's a large concern on supply with that. Does that equate to a higher price? I'll leave that up to you.
In responding to a question about the way forward, now that the U.S. is no longer party to the Trans-Pacific Partnership Trade Treaty, Miller explained that the current thinking is to push bilateral agreements.
The promise during the campaign was bilaterals, correct? I mean, that was one of his platforms. The difficulties with bilaterals are they are very lengthy to negotiate and to sign. And as we found out this last week, the president is overseas right now, and that was one of his talks in Japan, was a bilateral agreement. And from what I read, the Japanese aren't quite ready there yet. They're still hinging on TPP. And their hope is eventually we would come back into the TPP market. But bilaterals are the dream. That's what you would like to see, but they're very, very lengthy. It takes 6-7 years to negotiate something like that, and the clock's ticking right now.
The Pacific Northwest wheat industry, including yours truly, promotes the quality of Northwest wheat, and we're moving the needle in the right direction, which is why it was frustrating to the region's grain industry when the National Wheat Foundation's Wheat Yield Contest didn't include a component for quality. A letter from the three Northwest states was recently written to the foundation about the message that having no quality parameters was sending our customers. In response to a question, Gould, who as NOG CEO also leads the Wheat Foundation, which sponsors the contest, explained the organization's way forward.
Well, as many of you know, NOG, or through our foundation, we run the National Wheat Yield Contest, which is that's exactly how it started off, was a yield contest similar, hopefully someday to be the same size of the corn growers. This is our first year that we have added a quality component, and I'll be happy to discuss that further through the programming through this week, what that will look like this year, and then for the next year, so at the end of 2018, we're hoping to have that quality component either as a separate type of competition or as a factor into who will win. But just as Mike demonstrated, you know, here in the PNW, where you usually receive predominantly a little higher prices because of your export market capabilities and the type of wheat that you're growing and the demand in the Asian Pacific Rim, you're seeing a better time than those in what I call mainly the I-35 corridor, going from Texas all the way up to Kansas and Nebraska, North and South Dakota, where just last week the average price at the elevator was about $3.23 a bushel. What we've done at NOG is we had Craig Burning, our government relations coordinator, do research over the past 10 years looking at all six classes of wheat and all the major geographical areas that wheat has grown in the U.S. and take a 10-year average, and it roughly came out to about $6.82 a bushel as cost of production. So if you're in the middle part of the country where a substantial part of our production, wheat production is grown and you're only receiving $3.23 a bushel, we've got a major problem there. So, you know, if there's a way that we can start factoring in premiums for quality, especially for the middle part of the country where we're seeing these lower prices, which we're hoping that the National Wheat Yield Contest with a quality component will start to emphasize that to our buyers. And I continue Also, not only is the CEO as NOG, I'm the executive director of our foundation. We are reaching out to the bakers and the millers and appreciate our relationship with Arden Mills, and who is one of our industry partners council. I've had the opportunity twice now to meet with one of the top VPs at Bimbo, the world's largest bakery. And one of the things that they said to me was that they feel on their part they have failed to communicate with the growers exactly what the quality specs are that they're looking for here for our domestic consumption and use.
Did you hear what Gould said? A 10-year study of all regions and wheat classes has revealed a break-even price of $6.82 a bushel. That's higher than I thought, which means current prices are worse than I thought. Craft breweries are all the rage, and a lot more malting barley is going into the growing segment. In response to a question about craft breweries and barley demand, Little said millennials are into trying different things, and craft breweries are high on their list.
As the brewing industry has matured, the major brewers have actually been losing market, whether it be to other spirits or to the craft brewers. But the craft brewers have been increasing their influence in society. As the millennial generation grows, they're trying different things in the alcohol arena. They're still drinking, but they might be trying a different wine or but they do enjoy these craft breweries, and that segment has been increasing, and that's really good for the malt barley industry, because craft brewers use barley as their adjunct. So maybe three times as much barley goes into a craft brew as a regular brew.
Did you catch Little's comment that craft brewers use three times as much malt barley in their recipes as industrial brewers? Still, industrial malt barley use dwarfs all craft beer use, which is part of Little's cautions that farmers can't ever lose sight of the big boys. That's all the time we have. I hope you've enjoyed episode 52 of Wheat All About It, or what I'm calling Straight from the Horse's Mouth, about the panel discussion at the Tri-State Grain Growers Convention, which took place November 9th, 2017 at the Grand Hotel in downtown Spokane. Your voice does make a difference. Call or write your congressional representative to let them know you support NAFTA. Then join me again next time for another episode of Wheat All About It!
We're all children of a special treat, a miracle of nature that we just call wheat. A crop that's in the Bible, a crop that's in our bread, a crop that's filled our bellies and held us in good stead. Through a history of starvation and times of want and woe, wheat has been our savior, our grub, our glue, our dough. There's always lots of problems when we have enough to eat, but there's only one dilemma when there's not enough wheat. We feed you.